I'll now ask Clyde Snoblin to present to us his class entitled Anti-Semitism Today.
Well, good evening, everyone. First of all, tonight I would like to recount a couple of personal experiences of mine, although I guess one of them is a full personal experience, the other one's a half a personal experience or something like that. A number of years ago, I had some business associates who were Nazis. I mean, I don't think you could say define them in any other way than the fact that they were Nazis. And they were part of a very strong group of people in Victoria who were supporting in court some Holocaust deniers. It was back in the 90s, I guess in the 1990s. And I know two or three of them are actually business associates in the horticulture industry, and from time to time we sent them from the college class that I was teaching, we sent them students on practicums to their places of business. And there was no doubt that we both understood each other. They understood what I thought about life, and I understood what they thought about life. But one day when we had a student there, I got a call from the student who was really, really freaked out, and he says, "Clyde, you got to come and get me, take me out of here." And I says, "Well, what's wrong?" And he says, "You got to come right now and take me out of here." And the young man had gone out to this place on the bus. And so I went over there, and here were these big men sitting around having coffee and smoking and talking about the Jews. They were serious business, and in front of my student. They're kind of sort of... Well, they got really, really into this, right? And seething, kind of, and plotting and scheming and talking about the Jews and the alleged misdeeds of international Jewry and their plans for world domination and all their literature, including the Kabbalah and the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, and all about their books and papers and propaganda on the Holocaust denial and their information and spin and intimidation and crazy delusional paranoia about this whole thing in front of my student. So I walked in and I said, "That's it. No more students for you. We're out of here." "Oh, come on, Claude." You know, they were kind of saying, what's wrong with that? "You don't do that in front of a student. This is nuts. We're gone." Now, when I left that day, I was kind of thinking, so what's their problem? You know, what's all this fuss and angst about the denial of the Holocaust? And one of the gentlemen was there, was a lawyer, and he was involved in defending a fellow by the name of Ernst Zundel, who was a promoted books on the Holocaust, denial of the Holocaust. They weren't denying that he promoted this information. They were just trying to defend the fact that he had the right to say these things. And I can't imagine as I walked away, there was this kind of really, really strange sort of thing going on, and I walked away from it feeling kind of a bit relieved with my student, sort of my power to take my student away. What was their problem? The other's kind of a half an experience. This summer, our assembly here and the assembly in Sydney had a storefront and had some signs up in the store about the second coming of Christ and the nation of Israel, and there was a sort of a Bible exhibition in there, and it was set up so that people could walk in off the streets, and there was volunteers that went out and staffed this place in the afternoons and in the evening. And there was coffee in there and no cream because it tended to go bad. So there was, you know, coffee made and so on, and some cookies, packaged cookies and chocolate bars. And I was out there doing a couple of afternoons doing my stint. And my nephew Mark, who was kind of in charge of the thing, was giving me kind of the scope of what was going on and what to expect. And he was explaining the people who dropped by. And there were sort of some people who had developed a pattern of dropping by. And there's this gentleman that comes along, and he likes chocolate bars, and he will talk to you for a while and see if he can get maybe one chocolate bar down and then get another one before he leaves and goes on his way downtown. These people weren't sort of, were sort of Sydney street people. They're out there every day on the street. This other gentleman who liked the cookies, and he would talk, well, he got a cookie and ate it. And Mark had this all laid out for me so that I could anticipate this thing. But the gentleman, he said, that got the cookies, he was a Holocaust denier. And he was quite animated about this. And he would come in, and as he was getting cookies, he would talk about the Jews, the same stuff that my friends talked about, and about their plans for world domination, financial domination, and the conspiracy that was going on in the world, and so on, and the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. The more he talked about it, the more excited he got. And finally, when he had his mouth full of cookies, my nephew Mark said to him, "So what's your problem? You know, sir, what you're doing right now is standing there in front of me in this storefront in Sydney fulfilling Bible prophecy." And this really, really got him uptight, see? Now, that's probably what I would have said too. So what you guys are doing is just fulfilling prophecies that are 3,000 years plus old. And we're going to have a look at some. And Dave read some from Deuteronomy chapter 28 tonight. They don't even get that, right? They're just full of this sort of rage that they have. What's the problem? The problem, I'm going to suggest to you, that the problem is in fact the miracle. If there wasn't something in this, these people wouldn't be so uptight about it, in my simple kind of way of looking at things. Israel, friends, exists because God exists. And if there's been anti-Semitism now for a good 3,000 years, certainly 2,000 years, but probably 3,000 years, if that's been going on all this time, of a whole world and civilization picking on this little group of people, then there's got to be something in it. Israel exists because God exists, and Israel exists to prove that God exists, and it drives people crazy, literally. Now, what am I going to do here? Yes. This gentleman here is sort of the latest in a whole list of anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers. But this is an interesting thing. More about that, God willing, in a few moments. But he's one of the latest international figures that's come forward saying that he's proud. This is Associated Press and Haaretz News Service from Israel. He's proud that he has made the West and other nations angry about his comments about the Holocaust. A report by IRNA quoted Aminijab as saying that angering the world's professional manslayers, an apparent reference to Israel and some of the West, was a source of pride for him. What's his problem? What's he getting so fussed up about? Now, this morning in the Times columnist, I'm not going to say anything about the Times columnist, other than the fact that this morning there was a very good editorial in the Times columnist. And as a matter of fact, it was so good, I printed it out. It's not only good, but it was just opportune for this presentation this evening. 65 years ago this month, the first death camp in Western Europe was liberated by Canadian soldiers. Now you say, well, if somebody wants to deny the existence of the death camps and deny the Holocaust, what this article says is that you ought to talk to some Canadian soldiers who were there. Not just one or two, but thousands of Canadian soldiers that were there and actually entered these camps in 1944 and liberated, whatever that meant, liberated these camps. The horrors they uncovered shocked the world. These are Canadian soldiers. It wasn't just Canadian soldiers. Of course, it was American soldiers and Russian soldiers and British and Allied forces soldiers, but there was a large contingent of Canadian soldiers that went in there. But with the passing of time, memories have faded, the editorial goes on to say. And there are growing numbers today who question whether the Holocaust really happened. It's an amazing thing about history. Give it a little bit of time, you get a completely different spin on things. And really what this article is saying is that a bunch of Canadian soldiers need to step up to the plate and say, hey, there was a Holocaust. I was there. I saw it. Inexplicably, there have always been dissenters. In 2000, a British court ruled that historian David Irving, and he was in the news back then on this subject, deliberately manipulated evidence to conceal the extermination of Europe's Jews. In Canada, Ernst Zundel, which was the client of this associate of mine, published books and pamphlets with a similar theme. He was deported to Germany in 2005 and sentenced to 5 years in prison for inciting racial hatred. And they think that this is their cause in life, that they need to be doing this. But those were the work of isolated cranks, it goes on to say. Their claims were swiftly rejected, often with the force of law. Now, there's something uglier, the article goes on to say, happening in Europe today and in the Middle East, and that is that there's ultra-conservative nationalist parties in Europe that are coming forward very much like Hitler's party in the 1930s, and their reaction to a dramatic change taking place in the nature of societies in Europe, which include a huge shift taking place towards what may well be in 15, 20 years an Islamic-based Europe, a completely different continent. And they're campaigning, these right-wing parties, on the platform of identity, tradition, and sovereignty. Parties, officials have flatly denied the Holocaust. So what's this all about? There's people living today, Canadian and American and British and French and Dutch soldiers, who have actually were there. Few of these doubters had personal experience of the Holocaust. Perhaps that explains some of the skepticism, though not all of it. But if the passage of time is to blame, all the more reason for those who witnessed this tragedy to speak out. Canadian soldiers, better than most, can do so. In the closing days of the Second World War, our armed forces marched deep into Germany-occupied territory. The scenes they encountered have no parallel in human history. Their ordeal began in October 1944, when units of the 1st Canadian Army liberated the Vught concentration camp in Holland. This camp was built as a deportation center, kind of an assembly point. Some 12,000 Dutch and Belgian Jews, including 2,000 children, were housed there as a staging area to be finally sent to their deaths, and hundreds were actually executed on the spot. When Canadian soldiers arrived, most of the prisoners had already been killed or taken away. But the gallows, shooting pits, and crematorium left no doubt what had happened there. And that was only the beginning for these soldiers. Advancing from the west, Canadian, British, and American troops came upon a string of death camps. And it goes on to say their names are synonymous with horror. Belsen, Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald, Dachau, Treblinka, Auschwitz, and so on. Even then, the British SS and the Gestapo would not give up their prisoners and march them back to the back of the line in order to try and execute them before the Allies could get to them. An amazing, horrendous event. The final death count took several decades to verify. Where possible, camp administrators, of course, destroyed records and concealed evidence. Nevertheless, at least 6 million helpless victims are known to have been liquidated. About 1.5 million were children. Of course, they weren't all Jews, but the largest percentage of them were Jews, specifically. There were Christians and Jehovah's Witnesses and gypsies and disabled and other people kind of thrown into it. None of this is conjecture, the article finishes with. The broad facts are indisputable. Anyone in doubt can visit Vimy Place in Ottawa. The Canadian War Museum is there. Among its archives are the reports of men and women with no reason to lie, soldiers, journalists, photographers. What they saw and never forgot was the apparatus of mass murder. Holocaust denial is a slander on history. It is also, in a small way, a slander on the thousands of Canadians who encountered evil and understood what they saw. Now, we're thinking about this in the scope or within the title that we have of anti-Semitism today. And here I thought was this a remarkable article in the Times columnist, that really tells us about the state of the world. It really hasn't changed a bit. Somehow, almost inexplicably, this hatred and this problem goes on. It never leaves the news. It's always with us. And I say, what's their problem? Now, here's an article from IsraelNationalNews.com, and they were publishing a report from the Jewish People Policy Planning Institute, JPPPI, that tracks Jewish populations around the world. And they come to the conclusion at the beginning of 2007 that about half of the living Jewish people on earth now lived in Israel itself. As a matter of fact, it's just a bit more than 50% of the total world numbers, total world population, actually lives in Israel. The birth rates in Israel are slightly higher, or I guess according to this, dramatically higher, than they are in what they call a diaspora, which is the Jews living outside of the nation of Israel. But in any case, we have to ask the question again, what's their problem? I mean, 13 million people worldwide wouldn't be enough to populate the four largest cities in Canada. And yet there's this continued anxiety, paranoia, and hatred against this identifiable group of people. 7 million of them are essentially right now sitting in this high-tech ghetto in Israel that is vulnerable to a couple of atomic bombs from Iran. I mean, it would be the end of Israel. Here they are, half of them, just in one small, and I'm going to call it a ghetto because, you know, they're just surrounded and everybody is trying to attack them. And, of course, Iran, which has been most in the news recently, the Iranian defense minister, he warned Israel recently against launching any attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, they just fired some test missiles the Iranians had. Fired some missiles that were reportedly capable of hitting Israel. And his little piece of rhetoric that went along with it was that if this Israel attack happens, which of course we do not foresee, says the defense minister of Iran, its ultimate result would be that it expedites the Zionist regime's last breath. So this is pretty heavy language, isn't it? That if Israel tried to attack Iran to, for example, remove their nuclear capability, it would bring about the last breath of the Zionist regime. Now, again, this is worrying stuff, really, and should be for the world, because Israel has come out and said in news reports that they will probably attack Iran before the end of 2009. And I read one news report that said that they were recalling from around the world their special operations forces to prepare for something. So Israel is not unaware of her predicament. But in any case, all this huffing and puffing, it never ends against Israel. And again, we have to say, so what's their problem? The Muslims, for example, who are probably Israel's worst enemy. I mean, if you looked at the whole world population, then as a group, Islamic people would probably be Israel's potential worst enemy. CBC News, October the 8th, 2009, nearly one in four of the world's 6.8 million billion people are Muslims. So that means about 1.57 billion Muslims on earth, and 13 million Jews. Now, I'm not sure I got this right, but I did the math, and it looks like for every Jew there is on, living on the face of the earth today, there's 12,000 Muslims. My calculator didn't seem to just want to do that with the billions, and maybe it's just my eyesight, but it's something like that. So again, I have to say, so what's their problem? What is their problem? It's not only in the Muslim world, it's all over the world. Here is a Honduras radio announcer who just recently said that, well, he referred to the famous Holocaust and added that, "I believe it should have been fair and valid to let Hitler finish his historic vision," coming from Honduras, these statements. It's everywhere. Practically every country on earth, it's there. Everybody getting in on the act, as if there's this deafening din of negativity against this little identifiable group of people. What's their problem? Now, one of the other recent bits of information, when we think of anti-Semitism today, we think of the United Nations. Unhappily, we have to think of the United Nations because certain groups within the United Nations, and probably the United Nations himself, have been interestingly anti-Semitic for some time. One could come to that conclusion if you just sort of looked at what's said for Israel and against Israel in the United Nations for the past 40 or 50 or 60 years. And clearly, there is an endless barrage of negative, slanted comments against Israel. Now, the war that they had in Gaza last winter was a bit of a problem because the folks in Gaza had been lobbing missiles, as we all know, into Israel for years. Thousands of missiles, randomly, into Jewish homes and schools and farms and factories. For years, thousands of these missiles. All the time, the nations of the world urging for restraint. Now, of course, Israel took their forces out of Gaza a year or so before. And there was supposed to be sort of a peace offering, and everything would sort of settle down. But, of course, what they did, they set up the Hamas and so on, set up these launching platforms for rockets within the populated areas. Now, I guess from a military point of view, if you analyze the war, and I'm not into that, and I'm sure most of us aren't, but there seems to be pretty good evidence that the Israeli army and the Israeli military forces launched and executed what would have been probably a pretty precise war. Thinking of trying to get out these rocket launchers in the middle of schools and families and so on is a pretty difficult thing to do. So overall, the Israelites or the Israelis are convinced that they did it as humanely as they possibly could. Well, the United Nations Human Rights Council thought that it would be best to have an investigation into this. And a judge, I guess he's Robert Goldstone, who's a South African judge, was appointed to head this panel. And the panel was pretty... Report and the findings were pretty much slanted against Israel. And this is the Can West News Services, October 17th. The Coalition of Arab, Muslim, and leftist-run Latin American countries in the 47-member council were responsible for more than half of the 25 votes in favor of this resolution, which makes a series of demands on Israel, but none on the Palestinians. So it's okay to lob missiles randomly into a sovereign state, but if they fight back, this is wrong. This is a basis for war crimes. Even the author of the report, South African judge, Richard Goldstone, criticized the resolution as being one-sided. So even he thought that it was a bit one-sided. So anyway, his 574-page report, which the Human Rights Council commissioned, is itself largely focused on Israel, but concludes by saying both Israel and Hamas, the Islamic Palestinian organization that runs Gaza, should investigate war crimes allegations against their respective sides. Anti-Semitism today. Clearly, the demonizing of Israel. Like, I don't think there's any other way to say that this international demonizing of Israel continues, and what's the purpose of that, if not to get them to perhaps agree, the Jews that is, to agree to another Holocaust. I mean, this endless demonizing, what is the outcome? What is the result of that? Well, here's the other report that I have here. This one from Debka File on the same report. So what are we to conclude when the nations gather to accuse and castigate the only democratically constituted government in the Middle East in a frenzy leading to talk of invasion? What are we to think when Iran threatens to wipe Israel across the face of the earth and neither the UN, the US, or the EU allows Israel to defend herself? Clearly a one-sided event. Now, I say, what's their problem? 13 million Jews? What's their problem, really? Now, from the Pharaoh of ancient Egypt to the pogroms of Europe to the latest enemy of Israel, the leader of Iran, we have to say, what is your problem? And there can only be one answer to that, in my opinion. And that is the miracle of Israel. These people, these persecutors of Israel, in all of their self-appointed power and authority and their cause, their righteous cause, are there actually because God allows them to be there, because God is in control. Why else would this group of people survive so long? There is a miracle, pure and simple, and the miracle is Israel. Israel, again, as we said before, exists because God exists. There is a supernatural, eternal design behind everything, and it drives everybody crazy. Now let's have a little biblical shower here of what this is all about and where it came from. What other nation on earth has 3,000-year-old, 3,500-year-old information clearly written down about it? About its reason for existence, its history, and the outcome of history. And in all of history, really, I guess, and I'd have to, you know, say in Western history, because I've been raised in this notion that European and Western history is the only history on earth. And of course it isn't really, because there's places like China and there's the Americas that went on with histories that were synonymous with the great histories of ancient Egypt and so on. But we're just thinking about how where we came from and where Israel came from. This statement is recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 32, and I'd like you to turn with me, if you would, for a few moments this evening to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy really is the title deed of the land of Israel for the nation of Israel. The terms of the covenant, basically, of the land are written down clearly here. It's an interesting it's an interesting covenant, because in most covenants, if one party doesn't keep the covenant, then it breaks the covenant. That's it, basically. But in the case of Israel and God and the land of Israel, one party continually broke the covenant. And as a matter of fact, that was prophesied here in these chapters in Deuteronomy through the words of Moses. Israel continually broke the covenant. But that didn't change God's side of the covenant. And that's why people like the president of Iran today are still having this problem. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, he set up boundaries for the people according to the number of the sons of Israel. Right from the start. Right from the beginning, when nations became nations and nations became distinct nations and started to, you know, populate the earth. Way back then, God set this up and said, there's this little place here and there's these people here, and they're going to be there because I put them there. For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted inheritance. Now, for Bible readers, this is an exciting thing because we can stand up here tonight in 2009 and say, well, what's going on? These people are in their land today, and this thing still is going on. What other nation? How else could this have worked if there wasn't a miracle? Well, let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Some very remarkable things said about this nation. Deuteronomy chapter 4. And Moses here, the leader of the nation, was reiterating this covenant to the people and talking to them about the way it was and about God. In verse 5 of chapter 4, he says, see, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of. Now here the nation of Israel was sort of between Egypt that they had left and the promised land of Israel they hadn't yet entered. So Moses is reminding them that as they went into the land, they were taking these laws with them. And they needed to be aware of it, the fact that they were going into the land based upon this covenant. Verse 6, observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations, who will hear about all these decrees and say something like, wow, this great nation is a wise and understanding people. So it was the purpose of God to begin with to put Israel there in this land, in this special place, to be a witness to the nations, so that Israel wouldn't just be the recipients of these great laws, but the nations would look at them and say, that's good stuff. We should do that too. Verse 7, what other nation is so great as to have their gods near them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? It wasn't just that God gave them these laws. He opened up a line of communication with these people. There's no other nation on earth. It was completely unprecedented to that day and to our day in which we live. And what other nation, in verse 8, is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today? And included in this body of laws is the Ten Commandments, which we find in Deuteronomy chapter 5, which are the basis of, I think, even today, much of Western law in terms of our property rights and our relationship with our neighbors and so on. Now, having said that, in chapter 4 and verse 27, there was a warning that said that if you don't keep these laws, the Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and only a few of you will survive among the nations to which I will drive you. And that is an interesting comment there too, isn't it? Because originally, when God set this nation up under Abraham, who was the father of the Jewish nation, he said he would make the numbers of the Israelites as the sand of the sea and as the stars of the heaven for multitude. But this warning comes in that God says that if you don't follow these decrees, you will be scattered among the nations and you will survive among the nations, which Israel has done to this day. But there will only be a few of you, 13 million people. Not a large number at all. Verse 34 of the same chapter, has any God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another nation by testings, by miraculous signs and wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, or by a great and awesome deeds as he did to the Egyptians? Has that ever happened before? Verse 39, acknowledge and take to heart this day that the Lord is God in heaven above and on the earth below. There is no other. This was a special relationship between the eternal creator God and his nation, Israel, that he had called out for his purpose, and that purpose was to witness to the world. And then there's lots more instruction to Israel as you go through Deuteronomy chapter 6, 7, and 8, and so on. And it was with miracles that the nation was founded. It was with miracles that the nation continued. If you look in Deuteronomy chapter 8, it says in verse 3 that God had humbled them, causing them to go hungry, and then feeding them with manna in the wilderness, and giving them shoes that didn't wear out and clothes that didn't wear out. Verse 4 of chapter 8, your clothes did not wear out and your feet did not swell during those 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, so the Lord your God disciplines you. This was a familiar relationship that existed between God and the nation of Israel. And their whole existence in the wilderness, their whole existence as they were in Egypt and they're coming out of Egypt, and their history to this day has been associated with a miracle. Now, we could go on through Deuteronomy looking at many of these verses. But let's go over to chapter 32, because in a moment of reflection here at the end of the book, Moses is writing, well, it's called a song, actually, about Israel, the nation that he loved and the nation that God loved. And following up on the verse that we had previously, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, he divided all mankind. He set the boundaries of the nations according to his people, Israel. And in this poetic language of Moses in chapter 32, verse 10 to 12, it says, in a desert land he found him, in a barren and howling waste he shielded him, cared for him. He guarded him as the apple of his eye. Not hundreds of millions of people, but a small group of people, identifiable people. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest and hovers over its young in verse 11, that spreads out its wings to catch them and carries them on his pinion. The Lord alone led him. No foreign god was with him. He made him ride on the heights of the land. This is intimate, familial language between God and his people. The Lord did not set his affections upon you, Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 7 and 8, because you were a large and numerous people, because you were a mighty nation, that you were great warriors, or because you controlled great, vast amounts of land. The Lord did not set his affections on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other people, for you were the fewest of all peoples. Now think about it again today, 13 million people scattered around the world, with half of them being in Israel. But this was because the Lord loved you. God made a covenant with Israel, and he is going to keep it. And that proves, of course, that God is eternal and that his nation is there to prove his eternal existence. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your fathers, that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery. The Hitlers of this world and the Aminajabs need to know that they're passing and they're temporary, just as temporary as Pharaoh of Egypt. And that Israel and Israel's God is eternal. And that Israel, again, exists because God exists. And any attempts that they make to try and destroy Israel or to defeat Israel will result in their own destruction. Because God has determined that he will bless Israel, as we read, as Dave read for us from chapter 28 tonight. But carrying on in this poetic language of Deuteronomy chapter 32, Moses says, the Lord will open the heavens and the storehouses of his bounty to send rain on your land in season and to bless all the work of your hands. You will lend to many nations, but you will borrow from none. The Lord will make you the head and not the tail. If you pay attention to the commands of the Lord your God that I give you this day and carefully follow them, you will always be at the top and never at the bottom. The other side of that was, of course, that if they didn't follow God's decrees, if they decided that they wanted to be like the nations instead of separate from the nations, then there's a whole bunch of evil that was going to come upon them. And that, of course, is part of the history that we know, that they have been driven out of their land and have been driven around the world at least for the last 2,000 years and have only come to life as a nation in recent history. He said to Abraham, of course, he said to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, at the very beginning of this whole event of the nation of Israel, I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on the earth will be blessed through you. And history has certainly proven this to be true, that what we have surviving after all of the tormentors of Israel is a remnant of Israel that exists today because God exists. Now, in Numbers chapter 23, it's one of the great dramas that took place in the life of Israel. There were many, but this one was really interesting because the king of Moab, by the name of Balak, knew that the nation of Israel was moving through beside his territory to enter into the promised land. And these folks who lived in these little countries that Israel was passing through knew the whole history of the nation of Israel. It had only been 40 years since the great miracles of Egypt. And certainly the legend of the destruction of the nation of Egypt were still alive and with the people. And he was really, really shaking in his boots because of this nation that was coming through. So he hires this prophet. He's kind of like a prophet for hire by the name of Balaam. And he tried to get Balaam to kind of bring about some curse upon Israel as his only sort of line of defense. And the interesting thing was that he couldn't do this, the prophet, Balaam. He sees instead a blessing on Israel. And verse 21 of Numbers 23 says, no misfortune is seen in Jacob, no misery observed in Israel. Verse 23, there is no sorcery against Jacob, no divination against Israel. It will now be said of Jacob and of Israel, see what God has done. And in verse 24, chapter 24 and verse 17, he says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. He says in verse 9 of chapter 23, I see a people who live apart. So what Balaam, this Moabite prophet, was saying way back then was that there was going to be no stopping in the end of this nation Israel. This was going to be a people who would live apart whether they liked it or not. And that is exactly what we're witnessing today. And that is why we have anti-Semitism today, because this situation persists. Jeremiah chapter 16. There's a prophecy there that says that God will send out fishers and hunters to regather the people of Israel, to restore them to the land of their forefathers. Men will no longer say, the prophet says, as surely as the Lord lives who brought Israel out of the land of Egypt, but they will say that the Lord lives who brought Israel out of the lands of all the nations where he had scattered them and where he had banished them. And that was a prophecy that was made about 600 years before Christ, 2,600 years ago, that this would take place. This is a great event in the future when Israel would be regathered. Fishers and hunters, a remnant would come back to the land of Israel. Now, the other thing we need to understand about this is that the prophecies are quite clear, and that is that when Israel returns to its land, and this furor is once again brought before the nations, there will be a gathering of the nations. Now, this we can see, I think, anyway, in all of this kind of demonizing of Israel that's sort of in every media today. So we have two things that we're told will happen. One is that there will be a regathering of the nation. And by the way, that will be a remnant. It won't be a huge number of people. It will be a small number of people. And when that happens, we're told there will be a gathering of the nations. And those nations are going to gather against Israel. And we can read about that in Ezekiel chapter 38 and Zechariah chapter 12. And we don't have time to go into that this evening, but I think we need to sort of end on that note. And the understanding that Israel is the miracle, Israel exists because God exists, and there is a specific plan that talks about the restoration of the nation of Israel, a remnant that would return to the land. And at the same time as that, the prophecies speak about a great gathering of the nations against Israel. And that is, of course, what we're seeing today. And I think in conclusion, we might just throw out this challenge, and that is that do we believe the miracle? Do we live day-to-day understanding that there is this great miracle taking place? And the more anti-Semitism we see, the more demonizing of Israel that we see, the more this emphasizes to us and should underline and underscore to us the reality of this miracle. I suspect that if we don't, and we take the other line of thinking that says, well, you know, I don't really think that's true, and I'm not really sure about all of that, in any case, that we are crossing that line into anti-Semitism. We're either with Israel and the purpose and plan of God, or we're against it. And if we don't believe the miracle, and we say, that's not true, and all that was said in the Bible about it is not true, then it seems to me that we are crossing that line into anti-Semitism. In Romans chapter 11, Paul, who was one of the most prolific writers in the New Testament, talks about the day when all Israel will be saved. That day is in the hands of God in terms of timing. We don't know when that's going to be, but we have a very good indication that it will be, A, when the nation, the remnant of the nation is brought back, and B, when there is a gathering of the nations against Israel. Very good sign and heads up to the whole world that the end of time is coming. So the challenge that I have as we close tonight is, are we prepared to follow the consequences of this miracle and live with this miracle and the reality of it, or pursue some other path, which I suggest is probably sort of anti-Semitic? Thank you.